next guest is a YouTube star, a pediatrician, a health policy expert, a debunker of myths, a pursuer of truth. He is Dr. Aaron Carroll, and he writes at The Incidental Economist. He is his blog. He is a professor at Indiana University School of Medicine. He's an author, and he's a regular guest here on Stand Up. He's our official health policy expert. Lots to talk about with him today. Please give him a follow on Twitter if you haven't already, at Aaron E. Carroll. If not, you're missing out. Man, are you cranking out these videos. I can't keep up.
Well, I've reposted some old ones, but yeah, it's about once a week.
It's really, really good. We've got to talk about mammograms, which
you've already written
the blog about last night. At just before 11 o'clock, you published this blog. You write horribly depressing news about mammograms. I was in bed, ready to go to sleep when I saw this study. It upset me so much that I had to get up and write about it.
That was literally true. I wanted to go to bed early last night. That did not happen.
You should go to bed, Pete Dominic, early. 7:15
Oh, my PM. God, no. Really?
Yeah, before, I believe, Jeopardy, during Wheel of Fortune.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, but you got to get up. I get up at 3:15, 3:30. Actually, I get up at 1:15, 2:15, and 3:15.
Oh,
and then I try
not,
to fall back to sleep.
I'll do that, yeah.
Last night, it's so cold here, in New York. Last night, my wife threw on an extra cover on the bed, but it only covered her. She got a tiny blanket out just for herself, like a children's blanket, just covered her. And I never say anything to her in the middle of the night because I don't want to bother her sleeping. But I said, you get your tiny blanket out for you?
That's awesome.
It. And she's like, yep, and went back to sleep.
That's awesome.
Anyway, about this study.
Oh, it's so depressing.
Why is it depressing?
Is
it right? Is it accurate?
Well, here's the thing. The methods look sound. It looks like it was really well done. The follow-up is incredibly long. The women who were in the mammogram group really, it looked like they got the mammogram so there's really, no sort of chance to argue that they didn't get the treatment that they were supposed to. But it's, the gist of it is they took, 25 plus years ago, they got about 90,000 women almost to agree to be in this study. And they randomized them to one of two groups. One got screening mammograms every year for 5 years or more, and the other got none. And I mean that, I say, like, when I write that, I expect people to sort of gasp in horror that, like, how could we possibly not give women mammograms, screening mammograms? Isn't that be malpractice or leave them at risk? But 45,000 women got screening mammograms, and 45,000 women got breast exams. They got no mammograms at all, and then they followed them now for 25 plus years to see what happened to them, because this is always what we need to know. You will hear, and I'm sure we will get calls today from women or from men who know women who will say, like, but I had, or I know someone who had, this diagnosed, and 13 years later they're alive. And the question is always like, well, would they have been alive without the mammogram? We just don't know. This study now gives the 25-year follow-up data, so you can know. Would the women who didn't get the mammogram be alive 25 years later? Would we find out? And the results were basically there were like just under 45,000 women in the mammography arm, and there were just under 45,000 women in the mammogram arm. And the difference, the number of women who died of breast cancer were like 500 and 505. It was completely statistically non-significant. Mammograms did not save lives from breast cancer. No, there were no more increases in lives saved by women who got mammograms than those who didn't, even 25 years later.
So I guess the question is, how important is it to find cancer early, and does a mammogram or just a self-exam, breast exam, better? Because
that's,
I mean,
exactly the question. And it's like, and here's the thing, it's like people
is the question that it's important to find it early? Is that the question?
Well, no one, we believe it's important to find it earlier than too late. That is absolutely true. Once it has become sort of like malignant and it has spread and it has gotten to a certain point, there are points where, wow, we found that too late. But we can also get to the point where we're getting too early, in the sense that we're screening so much that we're picking up things that aren't breast. I mean, this is always the concern with screening, is that you pick up a lot of stuff that's not breast cancer. And so that happened during the study. And the other finding was that, remember when I say that we didn't save any more lives? It was the same number of lives saved. But there were, like, in the original study period, there were 666 cases of cancer diagnosed in the mammography group and 524 in the no mammography group, which meant that there was, like, an excess of 140-some breast cancers that were diagnosed with screening, which didn't lead to increased saved lives. And 15 years and 25 years later, that number settled out at about 106 extra cases of breast cancer diagnosed. That means that those women got diagnosed and got treated, but no extra lives were saved. And they said that basically 20% of the cancers detected by mammography were overdiagnosis, which means that 20% had surgery or had chemo or had radiation and no extra lives were saved. It's like one case of, basically there's an overdiagnosis of one case of breast cancer for every 424 women screened. You know how many women get screened in the United States alone. That means huge numbers of women are getting overdiagnosed or getting overtreated, likely, and no extra lives are being saved. And that's just horrible. I mean, it's horrible. I don't know how else to sort of spin that.
So I, the reason why it's horrible, the reason why you're depressed is that you're basically saying mammograms aren't saving any more lives.
I should say this. There are ways and times at which mammograms are totally reasonable. High risk women, perhaps, or women with real good reason to be concerned about this. But if we just say every woman should be screened, which is really what we do here, from 40 to 49, or from 50 to 59, or from 40 to 59, if we just screen all women, it turns out that we don't save any lives from, it's very likely, we don't save any lives from breast cancer, and we're actually subjecting tons of women to overdiagnosis.
Because overdiagnosis is a bad thing because...
Yes. Well, one, it's cost. So I will say it, even if everybody else won't. One, it costs us a ton of money. And don't get me wrong, I'm not like anti-breast cancer money. I would rather spend it on treatment or support of women with breast cancer or support of their families or anything else that they need rather than continuing to dump it into a screening test program which doesn't save lives. So one, it's a huge cost. Two, it's a huge health burden because tons of women who get mammograms without saving lives are being told that they have disease that need, and what do we do when we find out they have disease? They get chemo, they get radiation, they have, they have mastectomies, they have surgery, and it's not, and all of that follow-up treatment, all the stuff we do after the screening mammograms is not saving anybody's life.
How is it not saving a life? If you've got cancer, if a mammogram finds that you've got cancer, and you then go get chemo or you have a mastectomy, how is that not potentially saving a life?
Well, because all cancer is not going to kill you. And we can't tell when you get diagnosed with cancer, whether this is a cancer which would never kill you or if this is a cancer that would kill you. And in the old days, we used to basically have to rely on just, exams and say, hey, by the time we feel it, that's when we get freaked out. That's when we're going to actually start treatment because that's the cancer we believe we will kill you. But as we get better and better technology, we can detect this stuff down to the cellular level. Not yet, but we could theoretically detect it at the cellular level. And then what happens when you start picking up cancer at that point? Well, is that cancer that's going to kill you or is that cancer that would, take 50 years to grow and then kill you, but you would be dead already? And so we don't know the answer to that. Well, we're picking up more stuff that is cancer with the mammograms, but it turns out a lot of it would not threaten anyone's life. They don't die.
How do oncologists know?
You don't.
What
this is the problem.
They don't.
You can't. This is the real problem, and this is important. Once they say, oh my God, you've got cancer, we don't know whether it's the cancer that will kill you or the cancer that won't kill you. And so that has always been the argument of why, we should get tested. We should find. But here's the thing: a study like this shows that. If you don't get it diagnosed by mammography, if we never find out, nobody extra dies. And if that's the case, don't find out, it turns out that almost all of the cancers that are extra that we're picking up by mammogram, none of, in other words, if we saw some increase in saving life, we could say, well, maybe you know, we pick up all this extra cancer, but 30% of it or so winds up saving life. But there was no statistically difference in life saved. And if that's the case, then it's, you know, by almost math, pretty much all of the extra cancer that we're picking up by mammogram doesn't lead to any increased reduction in mortality. So why find it?
I hate the phrase extra cancer. It sounds like something you'd tag onto a new improved brand of cereal.
Yeah.
Not with extra cancer.
Talk about this stuff. I mean, it's like,
it is.
What is, because one, I'm sure it's resonating horribly with some people, especially people who either are cancer survivors or no cancer survivors, or people who have had, you know, breast cancer. Yeah, I mean, it's just going to resonate.
What? Why? Because why? I mean, you can see this
into us that early detection is the key. That right. You know, people who have survived or who have, you know, been cured of breast cancer will be told, like, hey, you know what, thank God we picked that up early, that's why you're alive, and they've had surgery and they've had chemo and they've had radiation and they've lived in panic and fear for a long time. And again, you know, a study like this makes the argument of like, we would have been better just never, you know.
So I mean, the other thing is that you know, when a cancer diagnosis is not a death sentence, and I think often people just assume that it is, right?
No, it is not. In fact, what this showed is that a lot of the cancer that was detected never even had really the possibility of killing you. If we'd done nothing, you might have lived. And in fact, lots of women live a long time after they've been diagnosed with breast cancer. In fact,
well, obviously, as you can imagine, this issue generates a lot of phone calls. The phone number is 866-994-6343. I'm sure you're not surprised that the American College of Radiology called the study deeply flawed, incredibly misleading, arguing that it involved secondhand mammography equipment and poorly trained technicians.
Yeah, okay. But see, here's the thing. First of all, you have to get to accept at this point that they're now calling mammograms that we were using in the 1990s somehow horrible. And come on, it's like, you know, we're not talking about the dark ages here. We're talking about mammograms. Moreover, they picked up too much. Let's keep saying that over and over again. It's not that they missed cancer. They were over-diagnosing it. Mm. So it's not that they picked up the same number of cancers and, you know, it turns out they were missing lots of it and now we're picking it up. They were detecting stuff that it turns out wasn't killing women. That's how sensitive they were. And so it's hard to follow through on the argument that if only they could have seen more, that now we would see an improvement over what was seen in that study. Because, you know, making the test, we could get everybody an MRI and we could pick up everything probably even at a lower level, but we'd wind up picking up even more, you know, over-diagnosed cancer that was at a small level that might not make a difference. So it's, you know, at some point we just have to take a breath and question, you know, whether this is all good. Not everything is just an unadulterated good. There are harms and benefits to everything. And we will get to a point, and we've done this with PSA and prostate cancer too. Don't get me wrong. We're doing this all over the map, where we are just trying so hard to look for stuff that we often pick up stuff that doesn't make a difference or is a false positive. And that not only has a financial cost, but a health cost as well.
Let's go with Renee in New York. Renee, you're on a stand-up right now with @AaronEcarroll. Go ahead, Dr. Carroll. Renee.
Hi, Dr. Carroll. This is Renee Corcoran, and I'm just wondering why it was interesting. The first I just turned on the show, and you were talking about the first thing I heard was the cost, the overcost of all these methods for you know, doing the cancer tests and stuff like this. I have had cancer twice.
Yep.
My first cancer was diagnosed by a mammogram. I have watched 15 women in my family die of cancer. I am blessed with being one of the few survivors of my cancer. And I think what upset me the most is that this use of overdoing stuff, and it's another thing, it's interesting that it's a women's issue that you're speaking about, but it's the money and that I'm concerned about that you're talking about.
Yeah, but I would like to take 100% of the money that we're wasting on mammograms. I don't care if you take 100% of it and put it into treatment for women for breast cancer. When I say it's a bad cost, you're spending money on breast cancer that's not saving lives in breast cancer. I'm not saying spend it on something else even entirely. I don't care if you take 100% of the money and put it into helping women pay for their chemo who need it, or if 100% into putting support for women who need support for their children or family or help around the house while they're getting treated for their breast cancer. Spend it entirely on breast cancer, if you like. I'm saying that this is a waste if it's not working, and that's it's money. Money is not an unlimited amount. And every dollar we spend on a screening program, which is not saving women's lives from breast cancer, is a dollar we can't spend on other stuff that would save women's lives from breast cancer or help them and their families.
I just totally disagree with you, because if you're still talking about money, you're not talking about the lives of human beings.
But I just said that I would rather.
No, wait. I what do you mean?
I would want to take, if we have X amount of money in the United States, period, I would rather see it go to things that improve women's lives with breast cancer than things that don't.
Let me try, Renee.
Okay.
If I have $100,
yeah,
to save your life, I'd like to spend that $100 on surgery, on chemo, or even if it's terminal, for your family to help you with bills and so on, versus spending that $100 on something that's not going to help you beat your cancer, survive, or be more comfortable. What's controversial? What do you disagree with about that?
I disagree with is because, to me, surviving through and journeying through this cancer twice, is that there is no cost. There is no cost to me to want to live. There is no cost to any of my people. And giving the money to them is helping me in an outer way.
No, but forget about giving the money to them. Let's delete that suggestion.
Things do cost money. Have to own that things cost money.
Your treatment, you're not saying your treatment didn't cost money.
And I'm not even saying your treatment wasn't worth it or saving your life was. I'm not none of that. I'm saying that if we have to own, I mean, we just have to, that there's a limited amount of money to spend on health care in the United States or in the world or anything, because that is just how it is. If we just ignore that, there will be no money left for anything else. So there is a limited money. That is how the real world works. I would rather spend it on things that improve people's lives and actually do good than on things we're finding don't. And I'm not even saying lumping in breast cancer. I'm specifically targeting one thing. I make the same argument when I say every dollar that we spend trying to investigate whether vaccines cause autism is a dollar we can't spend on actual stuff to improve the lives of kids and their families who have autism. And it's not that I don't want to spend a lot of money on autism. I don't want to spend money on stuff that is not real, so that we can't do stuff that is real. And in this case, if it turns out that universal screening mammograms don't save lives and don't improve outcomes, I would rather spend money on things that would save lives and would improve outcomes for women who have breast cancer. I'm not even arguing put it somewhere else. If this doesn't work, if this is not improving the lives of women with breast cancer, why would we not want to stop it and actually divert whatever we were doing, in energy even, in that into things that would improve
Renee.
Breast cancer?
Okay, I just have one more thing to say, and I have a question. The mammogram saved my life. I am here today because the screenings were there. I took what I needed to do. I did what I needed to do. It saved my life.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I know that I will never convince you otherwise.
No, you won't.
That is the problem, is we cannot know what would have happened if you didn't get the mammogram. We just can't. That's just not how the world works. And the only way to try to figure that out is to do big studies where we actually give women mammograms or no mammograms and then see if their outcomes are different. And that was this study, and 90,000 women participated in it, and it turns out that the women who didn't get the mammograms were no more likely to die than the women who did get the mammograms from breast cancer. So I'm not going to try to convince, I'm not going to argue that you're wrong or that your belief is, but it is impossible to know on an individual level what would have happened had you not gotten the mammogram, whether it might have been a year later and you would have picked it up with a self-exam and had the same outcome or not. The only way to know it is a big study. That's what was just published, and that study showed that it didn't make a difference.
Okay, I understand. I'm being open-minded, but I have just one more personal question, if you could or would answer.
Yeah, go ahead, Renee.
Has anybody in your immediate family or in your any of your loved ones ever suffered from breast cancer?
Of course.
Almost every family in America can say yes to that.
I have many people I know in my personal life who have had breast cancer.
I think almost every family in America can say that. Almost every.
And I will tell you that those women were picked up both by screening mammogram and also not by screening mammogram. So it is not. We always are fixated on this one thing, but of course I do. I mean, first of all, I'm also a physician. It's like, how do you not? You know, it is part of life. Right. Cancer is part.
Renee,
of life.
Renee, we're so happy that you beat it and continued good health to you for sure. Thank you very much for your phone call. Let me go to Stephen in Florida. Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us. He's on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. You should be watching his YouTube videos. They're fantastic. Sharing them with your friends, et cetera. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, Peter. Good morning, Dr. Carroll.
Good morning.
So this question is kind of sort of linked in. I have a young child, a 2-year-old daughter. Now, I know I'm way ahead of the game here, but there's been a lot of controversy as far as HPV vaccinations now. I have gotten my children and both, my daughter and my son, their vaccinations. I plan on attending public school and things of that nature. And so I'm just trying to get your kind of gauge on what you think about the HPV vaccine.
Well,
that was the other piece. I'm sure that was next in Pete's topic.
Yeah, it was. That's why I took Stephen's call. He has a blog entry, Stephen, at the Incidental Economist titled, "Even 2 doses of the HPV, don't get the HPC vaccine." That's a completely different one that I just made up. The HPV vaccine are good, even 2 doses. And then there's a video that he made, almost 7-minute video about the HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
By all means, go watch it. And
the
Incidental Economist. Well, I'll tweet this out right now.
Yeah, I'm not.
Actually, Aaron, you tweet it, and I'll retweet it so people can see your Twitter handle. But go ahead, Aaron.
If you just Google my name, I mean, the blog will come up. The HPV vaccine, I absolutely recommend it for adolescents. I mean, your kids are too young. It's just for your kids. But yes, one, it absolutely works. It prevents genital warts. It prevents HPV infection. There's a whole belief that it's going to prevent cervical cancer since HPV is the reason. You know, it will take us time to have huge data to prove that. But even on the prevention of genital warts, they just published a study out of Sweden yesterday, which I talk about on the blog, that was showing that, girls who were vaccinated between the age of 10 and 13 and got all 3 doses had like an 8%, had a reduction of 92% in the chance of getting genital warts. That's a win. I mean, that's just huge. And even getting 2 doses reduced a ton of the chance of getting genital warts. Even getting 1 dose actually reduced it quite a bit. But, it absolutely works. The safety concerns are not real. This has been followed by, in studies of many, 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 many people. It does not increase the likelihood that girls are going to have sex, which is another of the concerns that everybody has. It just doesn't do all the bad things people worried about, and it absolutely protects girls. And it's turning out we're now even thinking boys, because, the rates of both throat and anal and rectal cancer are significantly on the rise as well, and a lot of that cancer is actually due to HPV infection as well. So I absolutely do recommend it. As Pete said, I have a nice video about it where I go through all of the data, and it's totally worth it. But it's one of the – I just posted on it today because this study was trying to even say, look.
Would you say – I'm sorry.
If you're not going to get 3 doses, even 2 doses, it just does good, period. So, yes, I recommend it in the recommended.
Anal cancer is a thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Come on, Peter.
Well, sorry, Steve.
So
sounds like a horrible
my
Where can you not get cancer is my question.
Yeah. Is there anywhere you can't get cancer?
I would imagine, in the tooth.
Well, can't we then just, whatever that cell is in the tooth, can't we just put that everywhere?
What?
Oh, no. Great idea.
I mean, I should be a doctor. Well, you guys aren't coming up with anything.
Nobel Prize. There you go.
Thank you. My work here is done. I'll see you guys later.
I think he had a question, though.
I do. I actually have 2. But the other question is there an age limit on this thing? I mean, would you suggest that maybe older adults and things like that go and get it as well?
Well, to be honest, if you don't get it early, it's almost not worth getting, because HPV is so prevalent and it is so easily gotten that, if you don't – if this is the reason you got to vaccinate kids super early, because once they start having any kind of sexual contact, they're going to get HPV.
Right, so just, once – So I'm sorry. So then, am I misunderstanding it? So are you saying that once you get HPV, then the vaccination won't help you at all?
No, it won't. Once you, because you're infected, it's too late.
What is the percentage of the population that is infected?
Oh, it is huge. I wish I knew, but I mean, high. Like, in, you know, we're way above 50, probably 75. I mean, it's high.
You hey, know, if I send you a picture of my scrotum, can you diagnose whether or not these are just pimples?
No, yes, I can. And I don't want that.
Peter, right. I can.
And oh, you can, Stephen. I'll send it over to you. Thank you, buddy. As always, great, great call. Mike in Wisconsin, you're on Stand Up with the Good Doctor.
Hi, Dr. Carroll. I know anecdotes are like opinions, and everybody has one. But my prostate cancer was discovered when I was 53 years old.
Yep.
The only way I discovered it was because I had a PSA test. I'd had all the digital exams. I didn't have the getting up the middle of the night urinary problems or anything. And an early PSA test saved my life, as far as I'm concerned.
And I will never convince you otherwise, but I'll say the exact same thing that I said to Renee. We don't know what would have happened without that PSA. Would your cancer have grown slowly for the next 5 years and then been picked up on a digital exam, and then your life would have been saved? We just don't know. Would your cancer have wound up just growing slowly for the next 30 years and you might have died of a heart attack instead? We don't know.
But don't you think these doctors tell the caller and patients like him, hey, glad we caught it now. It would have definitely killed.
I am not trying to argue with you. I'm just sort of saying, like, we just don't know.
No, but I'm saying the reason why people believe these things is because their trusted physician told them, you know, this. And by the way, does this study mean something for all cancers and early detection in general?
Well, okay, you asked two different questions. I want to get them both. One, absolutely people are hearing this from the doctors. Well, I think if you go to the Komen website, it says, like, there's no question mammography saves lives. It's just stated.
Susan B. Komen, yeah.
So it's stated as part of their mission. So, you know, there, people hear this all the time. It's not, I'm not in any way accusing people of sort of believing something they haven't heard from respected people. Doc, look, the radiologist, you know, you just told me that the Radiology Association doesn't believe this. And so I do not, you know, think we're going to see everything turn on a dime. I think this is going to be an argument and a discussion, and it will be hard to move the needle either way. So absolutely people hear this all the time. And even when, you know, you're saved, you want to believe. It's just human nature. You want to believe that it was the course of action that you took that led to the outcome that you have. The question is, we just never know what the other choice would have led to. Would it have led to something better, worse, or the same? We don't
Mike, thank you. You good, Mike?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. We've got someone who says they're an oncologist. What's your name? Samuel, is it?
Yes, this is Samuel.
Go ahead, doctor.
Hey, well,
you to prove you're an oncologist, but I'm sure whatever you have to say.
I did my training in radiation oncology. I believe it's a great study. I think it was well designed, and I'm glad the results came up. My couple concerns would be that the 40 to 50 group, we kind of know already, doesn't really benefit or does not benefit very much from mammography. The U.S. Preventative Task Force.
Yeah, but even then, though, I think the general public refuses to come to grips with that.
I'm not disagreeing
that the USPSTF said it. No. Yes, go ahead.
So I think the higher risk group is the 60 to 70 population.
Yes.
70.
Oh my God. Yes. And also, first of all, I said this 1,000 times. I'm discussing universal screening of women at low risk. That's what we're discussing. If you are super high risk, this doesn't apply to you. If you're 60, this doesn't apply to you. You know, all of those things. This is about 40 to 59 year olds.
Yeah, no, I've just, with the way the media is and the way it's going to be reported, it's going to be that mammographic screening is not helpful, which, again, in the 40 to 50 group, or maybe even the 50 to 59 group, it may not be. The other thing, I'm Canadian born, and this is a Canadian study. I just have a thought that maybe, and this is hard to prove, but in America, where our health system is so fractured and primary care is lacking and screening is lacking and breast exam by physicians is lacking, perhaps the findings might be somewhat skewed. The fact the Canadian system is so good that they're getting their annual exams when they have a complaint, it's getting addressed.
Yeah.
And that way the screening is kind of negated by a better health system.
Well, you're making my day, because I think you'll be the only person arguing out loud in the United States that that we need to continue the program because our healthcare system sucks so badly. But Okay, I'm trying to work that through in my head. I think we would, you know, but if that's the case, then what we really should argue is that we should be using screening mammography on women who have no health care or no primary care and aren't getting it, and that we should not be using it on women of means who do have primary care and regular exams. And, of course, what happens in the United States is nearly the opposite, in that, you know, women probably who do have better access to the healthcare system and who do have what we consider to be good health care are the most likely to get the screening mammograms, and the women who might benefit from a screening program because they're not getting good primary care also don't get. So it's the opposite would occur here. Well, that's I think it's a hypothesis I would consider. It just doesn't sort of apply to what's going on here.
And then finally, I think it's a little unfair to issue the fact that mammography technology has improved. I mean, the false positive rate is going down. We have tomosynthesis now.
I'm not arguing, but you would need to argue that simultaneously that the false positives were going up and also that it was able to detect stuff that you weren't detecting before where lives are going to be saved. And that's, you know, usually you're either increasing the sophistication so you can detect it at a smaller and smaller level, which by definition is going to pick up more false positives, or, you know, you could sort of go the other direction. But it would have to simultaneously becoming like super sensitive and super specific. And that's, I'm not saying it's not getting better, but, you know, we keep making this argument over and over again. And the early studies that said mammography was awesome were using even older technology. So we're going to believe those original studies that, you know, used even crappier technology, but then not believe the study that used better technology and was actually in the modern age of treatment where some of the drugs that we use are actually there. I think what we have to come to grips at some point with the idea that probably the vast gains that we've made in breast cancer treatment and improvement in breast cancer improvement is in treatment. We've made great strides in treatment. But I think that we're over-focusing on the detection and how we do that, and we keep running down this race where we want more and more women to get screened and more women to get detected, and early detection is the cure. And we do a much better job of treating it now. Than we did before, and that is where we need to focus perhaps our money and efforts, and not necessarily on continuing this massive universal screening program, which maybe doesn't save.
I want to hear what the doctor thinks response to that.
Well, I mostly agree. I'm just kind of thinking through this because it's going to affect my day to day practice. What I tell people, like today, probably I'm going to get to my clinic in 15 minutes.
Oh, God, yeah. I pity you for the day. Absolutely.
And my thing is, the other thing is, like, that we saw the PSA response when the task force set that out. Big breast cancer is a lot more mobilized and stronger than big prostate cancer. And I have a feeling that this is going to be just swept under the rug pretty quickly.
I don't think you're wrong. I think that the chance of this actually changing practice in the United States is low.
Really?
No other reason than I am sure. I think we know we keep talking about the USPSTF recommendations, but they were only a couple years ago. And what they said was there's a growing body of evidence which makes it, look like mammography doesn't do as good as we thought it did. This is even worse, but it looked bad.
Within a certain age range.
Well, just universal screening of young women just doesn't seem to save any lives. You know, it was before even this study was published, and so all they said was maybe we should just not make the default screen, and we should just let women talk to their doctors and make an individual decision about whether they should get a mammogram. In other words, we're saying that insurance should still cover it. We're saying that women should still get it. We're saying, you know, everyone. But it just should be a discussion so that, you know, if some women don't want it, they don't have to get it. And just saying that alone led people to lose their minds. And, you know, I remember, like, I think it was the chief of radiology at Harvard said, like, you know, this is unethical and they're going to murder people. And, I mean, it's just horrible or something along those lines. So it you know, that's how badly people reacted to, like, hey, maybe we should just let some women not get it if they don't want to. You know, what I would argue this study should show that we should flip it so that the default is not getting it and people have to actually go out and get it.
Do you both agree that, not that this is necessarily a conspiracy, I'm not suggesting that, but if we found the doctor, Melanie thinks she found him, it says he's a radiation oncologist in Maryland, is that right?
Yeah,
I don't want to say your full name on the air if that's you, but I don't mind. Doctor, is it Parikh?
Parikh, yeah, that's
right. Nailed him. We're good. Good job, Melanie. Also Melanie has cameras in your car, doctor.
Sort of crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, but do you think I want to get your take on both this because immediately we see. The radiology world rejecting this because clearly if people get less mammograms or less go to radiologists less in general for early detection purposes, that's going to really cut into the profits of the manufacturers, of the doctors, of the hospitals, etc. I mean that's a
huge downstream effect. It's going to be the mammographers. It's going to be the oncologist like me, it's going to be the drug manufacturers. Everybody's going to be affected by a lesser diagnosis of treatment of breast cancer. The foundations are going to lose money. The walks are going to get less people. There's going to be less pink ribbons sold, less pink helmets in the NFL.
Yep.
And I think there's going to be an enormous backlash to this. It's going to be called anti-women. It's going to be part of the war on women. And it's frustrating because the nuances are unfortunately not going to be absorbed by most people.
I think that was even true in your first caller, who immediately brought up the fact that I was like, I think she even said like that, that it's a women's issue, and I was like, take that out of it. I don't care if you take 100% of the money and keep it right in breast cancer. It drives me crazy to spend money and needed resources on things that don't work instead of things that do. But I agree, it will be twisted into, you're trying to hurt women, or you're trying to hurt medicine, or you're trying to get between a doctor and the patient, which all of these things will come in.
And we'll see that backlash, and we already have today, guys, right?
Yeah, you will see it, and it will continue. And, I mean, to be honest with you, you see it when we talk about prostate cancers, too. Men don't call it a men's issue, but the same things come out. There's obviously a huge amount of money tied up in this. I mean, you got to just own that. And it's not hard to watch people line up on, the sides of the aisle, whether they support or oppose this based upon whether or not their livelihood depends on it. That is just human nature. It's not a moral judgment. And we have to work to overcome those biases.
And we've used screening. There's only, this is my knowledge base, but we've had screening show a benefit for two cancers. We've had screening show a benefit for colon cancer, and we've had screening show a benefit for lung cancer. Both are sort of, not always, but pretty much fatal if you get it, or potentially fatal if you get it. But even those studies didn't show as dramatic of a benefit as one would think. With breast cancer, many are so indolent, the DCISs, the early stage, first stage of cancer, and people don't understand like the benefits of like how screening can be effective. There's certain.
And I want to bring up is that you're making an excellent point, and it's a subtle point, but it's even worth as long as we're getting this deep in the weeds. You said DCIS. So for everybody else, ductal carcinoma in situ, those are cancers which really, really, really don't kill people in great numbers. They're sort of the ones that get left alone. Those weren't even included in this study. So when we talk about over-detection or overreaction, that makes this study even more conservative. In other words, that protects sort of the mammogram group in this study because those weren't counted in the overdiagnosis. But in reality, they do get picked up more, and we know that they don't actually really lead to much death, and they still wind up sometimes getting intervened upon, although I think people are getting better about not doing that. So we know some cancers are indolent, as this doctor said. I'm sorry, I can't remember your name, and aren't going to increase the risk of death. And those cancers were even not included in this study, which makes it even more likely that this things could have looked worse.
Such a fascinating conversation. What a great number of callers, from cancer survivors to Dr. Simul Parikh, who is a radiation oncologist. Dr. Parikh, I'm so glad you're listening and called in. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Send me an email and perhaps we can have you on to talk about what you do and every aspect of it. All right. We've got to take a break, Aaron, and we'll come back in just a moment to continue the conversation. There's plenty to talk about in terms of the Affordable Care Act as well. If we even want to get to that, we've got so many calls on this issue.
Yeah.
And we really do have one of the best guys joining us. Aaron Carroll is on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. Read his blog at The Incidental Economist, where he's writing about this and HPV and everything else. And we'll be right back.
America's Next Top Model. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
Oh, no. Tina Wins had hung up. We had a sighting of our greatest, best listener. I'm going to go right to her, but she's not there anymore. Call back, Tina. 866-994-6343. Dr. Aaron Carroll joins us today to talk to us about the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show 2014. Dr. Carroll, are you surprised that a Wire Fox Terrier won the 138th Westminster Dog Show?
Yes, I thought the Border Collie had it locked up.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, after its showing in the grooming and shampooing stage, I just thought there was no possible way that it could be beat.
We'll take your calls now. If you disagree with Dr. Carroll's objection to the winner. Does the winning dog is a Wire Fox Terrier who does not look unlike a Civil War reenactment. He looks like he's got a beard.
Oh, God, I just could not be less interested. I'm sorry.
You put a scarf and a cap on that dog. It's basically Alfred.
I don't have a beard. I can't grow a beard.
You should, though.
You've got like a...
idealized version of me.
Yeah, just like your soul projects a beard. You have a beard aura.
Then I'm doing my job because I can't grow one, but I want people to know that if I could, I would have it down around chest area.
Nice. All right, now back to cancer, everybody.
So what's the best cancer?
Well, it depends what you mean by best.
I think that's up for you to decide as being the doctor.
Oh, God.
Least likely to kill you?
Most survivable.
This is the best.
No, I will tell you, I know so many women who had thyroid cancer and all had completely full recoveries.
Thyroid.
I think that may be one. Yeah, I don't know why.
So thyroid is your favorite. On the record, we're going with thyroid cancer.
It's the one
you
that
approve of.
I have, like, for some reason, it's like women that I know who work with me. It's when they come to me and they have bad news, I'm like, oh, please let it be thyroid cancer. Because then I know at least that's one they're going to most likely.
Great cancer or greatest cancer, Dr. Carroll?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
All right. I'm sorry.
I'm going to go with, I don't even want to touch that one.
All right. What cancer would you have a beer with?
All right. Shut up. Because I've got to get these callers and I can't make the point. I can't turn. Because Debbie apparently lost her husband to cancer. I'm sure she doesn't appreciate our jokes. Go ahead, Debbie. You're on the air with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Well, I appreciate the levity. Excuse me. I have a cold today. But I lost my husband. This April would be 7 years. Pancreatic cancer. When it was discovered, it was fourth stage. And I struggled with that question, especially in my anger stage, about whether he was African American. He just turned 50. He was actually 51 when he passed. And couldn't there have been some pre-screening, his doctor be more vigilant about, you know, he had diabetes in his family. That's a big risk factor for pancreatic cancer. What my research eventually, I think, even with a little bit of progress made 7 years of losing my husband, I realized the research pointed back to the results of this study, which is probably we would have discovered it earlier, and I realized pancreatic cancer, from the articles that I've read, kind of in you for a very long time, and it doesn't obviously metastasize, run into the lymph nodes in his back, and his back pains then presented the symptoms.
Yeah. I want to make sure I heard you correctly. You said pancreatic cancer, right?
Yes, pancreatic cancer.
All joking aside, that's almost the worst cancer that you're
Yeah, that's
with.
What you hear, yeah.
Pancreatic cancer is almost the most difficult to treat, the most difficult to cure, and it is just—it's a bad, bad cancer.
We
don't really have screening for pancreatic. This is the thing: it is so rare. I mean, I don't want to say it's so rare. It is on the rare side of cancers, and it is so difficult. Problem is, we don't actually have a great screening tool for pancreatic cancer. Like, we don't do universal screening programs for pancreatic cancer. We don't have, like, easy tests. And that's part of the problem, is that people get picked up often, and, you know, it's often too late. It's metastasized. And even when it is picked up, it is so difficult to treat. Because to screen for something, you have to have a certain number of preconditions that are set. The first is that you have to have a test which is going to find the disease with some sort of, you know, ability. But more importantly, you have to have a great treatment for it. You have to, like, know that if I detect it, I'm going to be able to do something awesome about it. And the third thing is you have to know in your heart that detecting it earlier makes a huge difference. Those things all have to be true for a screening program to work. And for pancreatic cancer, we don't really have a good test. We have some therapies, but they're not awesome. And, you know, we like to think that early detection would make a huge difference, but that's, you know, pancreatic cancer is just, I can't speak with any authority, nor can anybody else, on what a screening program would do, because we just don't know. It's right. It's just not a cancer that is massively well, you know, understood, or screening programs exist. And so I would not, I mean, as much as I can tell you, it's very, very unlikely you did something wrong, or like you could have screened, or you could have done something better, because it is not as if only you'd gone in for your yearly pancreatic screening test, this might have been detected. Those things really don't exist.
Well, and I agree with you, and that's what I'm saying. 7 years after, I've come to that conclusion. I'm a research scientist as well, so I understand evidence-based principles, which is if something's not effective, then the resources shouldn't be put towards, you know, towards an ineffective or less effective practice or program than something that would prove better outcomes. But the understanding here from the calls I've been listening to is that it's a very emotional issue, as you understand.
Absolutely. And I just, you know, and that's why it's difficult, is that I am not looking to have arguments, or I'm not looking to tell people they did the wrong thing. These are always personal choices, and everyone should do whatever they feel comfortable within their spectrum of their own health. But
when it comes to public policy.
Well, that exactly. And also when we talk about, you know, what we should tell patients or what we should announce as like universal screening for mammograms, you know, the results of this study does not appear to save lives. And therefore, we shouldn't probably publicly be pushing it, or we shouldn't be, you know, sinking huge amounts of money, public funds, into it, or even private, whatever we want to talk about. It should be a discussion that at least we come to grips with, and if you still want to do it, it's the United States of America, so be it, but it does, it may do more harm than good, and people should know that, and it's not an unequivocal good. It's not that you only, unfortunately, ever hear the stories of, I got early screening and it saved my life. You never hear, I got early screening and, oh, my God, it made me get surgery that, looking back, I probably didn't need and probably wouldn't have extended my life. And that doesn't ever happen. You only ever hear good, but when we look at it,
It does happen. You're just not something that people talk about.
You can't. It probably does happen, but you never recognize it. You just don't know.
So for most cancers, you're saying that most cancers, age is the highest risk factor, right?
Say again one more time.
You're saying that for most cancers, age is the highest risk
factor. No. I mean, there's lots of risk factors for breast cancer. I mean, you know, there are certain, genes actually that are risk.
She said for most cancers.
Except, you know, of course, lung cancer would be smoking. You know, that certainly is going to be probably the biggest risk factor for getting lung cancer. You know, thyroid cancer actually happens in younger women usually. So it's not universal across the board. It's just that in America, we got to own at one point, we're all going to die of something eventually. And if you live long enough, there's a belief, honestly, if men live long enough, 100% are going to have prostate cancer. That if we autopsied all 100-year-old men, they'd probably all have some form of prostate cancer early or late. It's just going to happen. And this is part of the problem with our prostate cancer screening, is that, of course, as we keep screening older, we're going to find prostate cancer. It's going to happen. But when you're 80 years old, and if I can say I'm going to prolong your life by 10 years, what are you doing? Why go through therapy, you know, when it's really likely you're going to die of something else before that occurs? And so, you know, you have to look at both sides of this.
Debbie, thank you so much for listening, for calling, and we're so sorry for your loss. Thank you for your call, though. Really appreciate that.
Me the airtime, and please check out the Citizens Campaign in New Jersey. I've been advocating for that for a while now, but I think
the Citizens Campaign.
Yeah, I think it fits into the theme of your show, which is to be empowered civically, and I think the founder would be excellent guest.
Send me an email with all the information, standupwithpete@gmail.com. Again, thank you, Debbie. standupwithpete@gmail.com. Steve, Illinois, has been waiting for almost the entire time Aaron's been here. I've got to go to him.
Good morning, Dr. Carroll. I was wondering what your opinion was on Otto Warburg's findings that cancer cannot survive in an alkaline environment.
Okay, which guy is that? I'm not sure who that is.
He was a research chemist in Nazi Germany, won the Nobel Prize twice for proving that cancer needs an acidic environment in order to live. A lot of people think that if you switch your diet to a strict alkaline diet, that cancer cannot live in you.
Well, you can. I think that, you know, if it was that easy, it would have already happened. And it's also, it's very hard, even if you change it to your diet from slightly acidic to slightly, you know, alkalitic, it's not going to change the entire, you know, alkalinity or acidity of your body. And so I think it's incredibly, while that might be a finding in the lab, it would be incredibly complex, if possible at all, to translate that into the human body. And I'd say again, believe me, there's a ton of money to be made in cancer cure. If that was that easy and that possible, some enterprising company would come up with the mechanism to find a diet or to find a pill that would do that and then reap the benefits and the financial rewards.
Thank you.
Keith, New York.
Hey there, Dr. I was reminded of a 2004 piece by Malcolm Gladwell when he talked about that picture problem and how when things get better at detection, you increase the amount of noise and you have problems finding things. And one of the things he mentioned in the article was an 87 study in Denmark where they autopsied hundreds and hundreds of women that died in their 40s, and they found DCIS tumors in over 45% of them.
Yep.
But only about 4% of the population winds up getting diagnosed with these things. So they found that, you know, over-detection would be a major problem because these things aren't going to be the issues that are killing these people. My question along those lines is what because I know we haven't been doing, you know, compared to decades and centuries past, that many autopsies. What effect would having more autopsies to find out what kinds of things are in our bodies, you know, that don't kill us before we die, have on, you know, our understanding of the false positives and false negatives when it comes to, you know, deciding whether we should have these mammograms?
It's not a bad idea, but it would cost a lot of money, it would take a lot of resources, and people don't want to do it. The flip side of that is, why do we go looking? You know, I say I'm a minimalist in practice, and my family will tell you this, and my friends will tell you this, that whenever they ask me inevitably, like, hey, should I get this test or that, I almost always say no. Because, most of these tests and things that we're doing have been studied in very specific populations, usually at risk. And so the studies tell us, well, in a person at high risk, when we find something, well, then it's very likely to be something bad because they were already at risk for it. But what we never know is what's the result going to be on a healthy person? We just don't know. We don't know that from any lab tests. We don't know that from any screen, like radiologic tests. We just don't know because we don't take tons and tons of healthy people and give them these tests just to see what we find. And so when they find something in a otherwise healthy person, it's more likely to be a false positive. And then you go down this chain, and I've had this happen. We call it a diagnostic odyssey, where you get a test you probably shouldn't have gotten, but some doctor convinced you to, and then you find something else, and then you find something else, and then you find something else, and then you find something else. And it costs, not only does it cost a ton of money, it's unpleasant.
Unfortunately, I have to cut you off. I hate to, but I get to heartbreak. Dr. Aaron Carroll, finish that online at Aaron E. Carroll, theincidentaleconomist.com. As always, we really appreciate it, pal.
Take care.